Welcome. My name is Ben Havish, and I'm a lecturer in politics and international relations here at La Trobe Albury-Wodonga. And today, as you know, I'll be talking to you about Mao Zedong. What do you know about this guy so far? From your reading, that apparently you don't like, according to Logan.
No, reading's fun.
No, reading's awesome when you get into it.
We haven't quite got to Mao Zedong yet. We've just started on the start of the Communist Party, so...
Is he like the founder of Marxism?
No, he might say that he was that important.
I don't know.
But no, Marxism has a much longer history, and it comes from Europe. And Karl Marx is the founder of Marxism, hence the name. But that's a long story, and we're not going to get into that. What I hope you get out of today is to realise that, at the moment, you're just reading about this in a book. You know, it's just a text, it's not real. What I want you to get out of this is that these are real people, this happened in a real place, it affected millions and millions of people, and these are some extraordinary events, some of the most extraordinary events in human history, which is why it can be really interesting to study. So I've brought a few minor cultural artifacts here to make it more real for you. Well, but first, I'd like to see where you're at. So in your opinion, why do you study history? Why would you want to?
Because I want to continue in uni.
Yeah, that's a very practical reason, isn't it?
It's interesting.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, very interesting.
So you don't make the same mistakes?
Yeah, which is funny, because humans tend to. But you're right. There's a phrase that goes around that says, history doesn't repeat, but it often rhymes. And you can learn a lot about your current predicament from what's happened in the past. So that's a good answer. Why else might you want to study history? That's right. What about Chinese history? Why specifically study Chinese history?
It's intriguing.
It is. For all the reasons I just described, it is very intriguing. Why else? What part of the world is Australia in?
Oceania.
Yeah, it's in the Asia Pacific region. Contrary to some people who wish it was parked right next to the British Isles, we in fact are in the Asia Pacific region, and China is the most powerful country in this region. So if you want to understand how the Chinese country and the Chinese government operates now, it's really handy to understand the past Chinese history to understand how they got to where they are today. And Mao Zedong is a big part of why they're where they're at the moment. Now, I do come bearing gifts. I'm going to grab one of them and pass them on. What you'll find on here is a timeline of modern Chinese history with some key events, when they happened, etc. Hopefully this can be a good study companion for you as you do your reading, just to locate events in the context of where they happen. On the back, you'll also find a copy of this map. Now, when you're studying international affairs or studying other countries, it's so useful to have a map with you. Because when you read something that happened somewhere in a book, you can say, oh, that happened in Chongqing. There's Chongqing. I know where it occurred. Hey, Alicia, come on in. So hopefully the timeline and the map can be really useful to you as you start studying Chinese history in a bit more detail. Yeah.
On the back, there's like 50 spares.
Yeah, just chuck them up the front and the... Logan, maybe you can take them for the people that couldn't make it today. So there's a few key themes I want to leave with you today. Yes, I'm talking about Mao, but to understand why Mao was so influential and so important for various reasons, you've got to understand what happened before Mao and the fact that China was really in a state of chaos. It was a mess. It was crumbling from within. Foreign powers were really intervening in Chinese affairs and tearing the country apart. And the country was divided with various kinds of internal conflicts as the Qing dynasty started to fall apart. So Mao comes on the scene. This period, this is Mao the revolutionary here on the Long March. He's important because he, during the revolution, he unites the country and expels foreign forces. So a country that's been in chaos for a long time, he manages to pull us back together. However, after the revolution, when he becomes the national leader, he makes a lot of mistakes because he tries to apply the lessons of being a revolutionary guerrilla fighter to trying to run a country, and it's two vastly different tasks. And obviously, this is the main story of when Mao was the national leader. Millions of people died for various reasons under his rule. Now, just a quick one before we start. When we're looking at Chinese words, when Chinese words are written in English, it uses a system called pinyin. And some of the pronunciations of the letters are different in pinyin than they are in English. So, you see an X, it's pronounced sh, as in shoe. ZH is pronounced j. OU is pronounced O. So when you see a place, Guangzhou. Q is ch, so Chongqing. When you see E, it's pronounced e. And an O is pronounced u. So, that's an example. Yeah, we'll come to that. Anyway, that's just important to know because a lot of people in Australia don't know how to pronounce Chinese names and places properly. And you'll be way ahead of the pack now that you know this. It'll make you sound more professional when you're talking about China. So what does this tell you on the slide here? And don't be afraid to pipe up. What I'm trying to run here is a very interactive class, so I'm going to ask you a lot of questions. If you've got any questions for me, just yell out whenever a question arises and I'll try and answer it for you.
That's the dates each dynasty ruled.
Yeah, that's right. Good. So what do you notice about the dates?
They're all in like several hundred years.
Yeah, they're really old. And these are major dynasties, but it goes back 4,000 years. So China has 4,000 years of continuous dynastic succession, 4,000 years of civilization, as they call it. They have a very proud history. They have a very long political culture. They have works of political philosophy that are very famous, that go back well before anything comparable occurred in Europe and in the West. So Chinese are used to being considering themselves as the center of the world. Now, does anyone recognize this place? Might have seen it when the Olympics were on a couple of years ago. Martin, what's that?
It's in the Temple of Heaven.
Yeah, where is it? Yeah, obviously.
Beijing.
Thanks, Lee. Yeah, this is in Beijing. It's called the Temple of Heaven, and there's a place in this complex. There's a little disc on the ground, and it's known as the centre of the universe. And that comes from the idea that China is the centre of the universe, the middle kingdom between heaven and hell, or something like that. So when you hear China called the Middle Kingdom, it means they think of themselves as the centre of the earth, the centre of civilization. Well, what's this? Yeah, the Great Wall of China. Do you know what's there? Emperor Nazi Gori. Why is it really there, though?
Keep the Mongolians out back to the back.
Yeah, so this tells you, if you think you're the centre of the earth, everyone else is a barbarian. That's the phrase that's often used in Chinese history. So this was to keep the Mongol barbarians out, because you don't want them polluting the civilised Han Chinese. So, centre of the world, everyone else is a barbarian. Important ideas moving forward. But then in the early 19th century, a few things start to happen. The centre of the world is no longer China, and the barbarians start knocking at the door and breaking through. So do you know anything about, first, what that is?
Drug.
Yeah. This is the opium poppy, and it's cultivated in various places in the world, in mountainous areas, to produce opium, which is the base also for the drug heroin. So what do you know anything about the opium war, the first one?
Do you mean Britain introduced it to China?
Yeah. Do you know why?
Because they've been winning.
What do you mean?
They got a lot of money out of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, they did. Why did they want to introduce this trade crop to China? What were they getting from China?
They were gaining control in China.
They did that in the process, for sure. Right, the British were importing a whole lot of goods from China, including tea. Tea was the main cash crop that the Chinese were selling to Europe. But the Chinese didn't want anything in return apart from gold and silver. And for the British, this was, you know, a serious economic problem. So they wanted to address the balance. So they started introducing opium into China, pumping it into China in a big way, forcing, you know, lots of people got addicted to opium, so there's a captive market. And all of a sudden, instead of paying for Chinese goods like tea in gold, the British traded it for opium. But at the cost, what do you think happened to China? What happened in China as a result of this?
Opium addictions, lots of.
Yeah, and what's the problem with drug addictions?
Medical problems that will occur after.
Yeah. This is an opium pipe that I got in China. Pass it around, have a look. No, I've not smoked opium through it.
Wishing.
Which always gets a laugh when I show that one around. You have a look at this picture and see, here's one of these bad boys here. What are they doing? Yeah, they're sitting around getting monged out. What aren't they doing?
Working.
Yeah, all of the above. They become dysfunctional. They become a drain on society. And also, what do you need to buy opium or buy drugs? Yeah, that's right. So if you're not working, if you're not getting a regular source of money, but you need money to buy your addictive drug, what do you have to do? Yeah, you have to resort to crime, don't you? So this becomes a big social problem in China in the early 19th century, and it starts to become a threat to social stability and to the government. And so in the First Opium War, the Chinese emperor says, all right, enough, we're stopping this, we're going to ban opium. They arrest a couple of British captains who are trading opium in one of the ports. And the British see this as an act of war, and they send in the Navy, and they pretty much blow the limited Chinese Navy out of the water and force the Chinese into submission. With the upshot that the British forced the Chinese to open up all their ports to British trade. So this is the start of the penetration of foreign countries into China that starts to destabilise the Qing Dynasty government. So you're with me so far? This is a long and complicated story. And here you see, I think this is around Hong Kong, Guangzhou. And you can see the Chinese junks here, no match for the artillery and cannons of the British Navy. But that was just round one. There's a second opium war about 20 years later. Do you know what happened here? Not yet. It's important, and we'll get to that. Because they're not far away in this story.
Didn't China get crushed again?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a very astute observation. China gets smoked again, pretty much. And this time there's other European powers involved, like France, like Germany. The United States gets in there too. And this is settled at the Treaty of Nanking. And at the Treaty of Nanking... Now, Nanking is known today as Nanjing. It's an important city in central China. But at this treaty, the Chinese are forced to open up all of these ports to various Western powers. So remember, before the First Opium War, China is essentially a closed shop. They think they're the centre of the universe, they don't need to trade with anyone, everyone else is a barbarian. All of a sudden, the barbarians are beating them handsomely and forcing them to open up. So it's really important to understand how traumatic this is, not only politically, but for the Chinese idea of what it means to be Chinese and its national story. They're no longer the center of the universe. So you see, China is starting to break up. There's starting to be internal turmoil. Their economy is starting to fall apart because of these social problems that are happening. The government is corrupt and ineffectual. So what happens? Has anyone heard about this? The Taiping Rebellion?
Yep.
Yeah?
There is.
Do you know what happened?
Didn't work very well.
No, not at all. And there's an Australian angle on this that I'll get to in a minute. But this is the worst civil war in history. 30 million people lost their lives in this rebellion, which happened down here in southern China. And the Taipings were a group led by this guy, Hung Xiuquan. Can anyone say that? Have a go, have a crack.
Hung Xiuquan.
Yeah, there you go. But pretend like you're in a kung fu movie and get the accent going. I know it sounds silly, but it's really good advice when you're there because they can't understand your skip accent when you try and pronounce these things. But this guy started this revolution on the basis of some weird mutation of Christianity that he'd developed. So part of the foreign penetration into China was Christian missionaries in the early part of the 19th century coming in and trying to get Christian converts. So this guy, Hung, and bear in mind in Asia, the first word, Hung, is the surname. Xiuquan is his given name. So Mr. Hung started this cult, this sect, on a really strange version of Christianity, and started a rebellion against the Qing government in the south, so in this area here. And it lasted for 14 years, lots of fighting, 30 million people dead. Now, what's the Australian angle, do you think? So here's the dates. What happened in Australia around this time? Especially around here, sort of. Made Melbourne a very rich place.
Was the gold rush?
Yeah, that's right, the gold rush. And we know that lots of Chinese people came to Australia from southern China, so from these areas during the gold rush. And one of the reasons they came here is because when there's a civil war happening, it really disrupts your ability to make a livelihood and care for your family. So a lot of people from in these war zone areas came to Australia, went to California as well in the United States where there was a gold rush on at the same time, trying to make some money, send it back for their family or make a new life in Australia. So it goes to show what happens on the other side of the world can impact you right here, and this region was right in the thick of that Chinese migration. Now you mentioned the Japanese. This is where they enter the story. So what's happened to Japan in the sort of middle 19th century? What's going on there?
When they start living here a lot?
Yeah, they have something called the Meiji Restoration, which the Emperor Meiji comes to power. Before that, they were, you know, an old school society run by shoguns who are like knights and nobles, like the Middle Ages of Europe. And Emperor Meiji comes to power and he defeats these shoguns, and he thinks, right, the Western powers, he sees what's happening to China, he says, if we don't want this to happen to Japan, we're going to have to modernise and become like a European power, get modern militaries, organise ourselves like a modern European country. And yeah, you're right, they start to become imperial, and they see China, they see how weak China's becoming at the moment. And that makes China ripe for the picking, ripe for the intervention of a strong power. And Japan's advantage is Europe's on the other side of the world, Japan's right there, and they can come and intervene more comprehensively than Europeans can. So this is the first Sino-Japanese war, and Japan wins handsomely. And all the fighting happens up here, around Korea, and in this area here is called Manchuria. But it's part of China now. You see, here's a drawing from the time. And the Japanese far superior fighting force, they destroyed the Chinese army. Here's some footage from the time. So again, China, what's the pattern here?
China gets smashed.
China keeps getting smashed. So what do you think is going to be the outcome for the government of China?
The people are going to lose faith in them and decide to not to go.
Yeah, that's right. So do you know what went on here?
The boxers are anti-foreign rebels who decided that the government wasn't actually doing a good job, and so they decided to try and overthrow the people who were in the treaty ports. And then Qing decided that they were actually Pixie decided that they were actually doing something decent, so secretly funded them and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Now this, have you ever seen a photo of this?
Yeah, I've seen it.
What is it?
She took the money from the Navy and
Yeah, it's made out of wood, but it's meant to look like marble. Now, Martin, you've visited here. I took this photo. This is at the Summer Palace outside of Beijing, where the Empress used to hang out. Where did the money come from for this? Yeah. They'd set aside all this money to have a modern navy so they could defend themselves against this foreign incursion. And the Empress Cixi goes and spends it on this. Now, this, when I went there, I thought this would be a great party location. And it really is. It's decked out to have a good time. But when your country is being crushed by foreign forces and you need every means of defence possible, this is not such a good idea, I should say, to spend your money on this. And this is a symbol to China of the corruption of the Qing dynasty and everything that's wrong with it. You've read about the Boxers. This is them, this is what they look like. Essentially, they're a terrorist group. They'd be called a terrorist group today. And they're anti-foreign, and they see the foreigners, as you've read, as the root of the problems in China, as well as the corruption of the Qing regime. Now, this is an interesting photo. This symbolises all the different countries that came to intervene in the Boxers. Because who did the Boxers attack in Beijing? Yeah, they attacked where all the embassies were. So if you attack someone's embassy, like if I armed you guys and went up to Canberra and attacked the Chinese embassy, that's an act of war on China. So all the countries whose embassies were attacked sent troops to Beijing to go and defend their embassies, defend the diplomats and the families that were living in there and who were trapped. So you've got troops from different places around the world. Can you identify any of them? Who's this guy from? There's a big city in Europe whose policemen look a bit like that these days. Yeah, he looks a bit like a Bobby, but this is an English trooper. What about this guy? He would be a serving with the British, but he's from India. It's identifiable. He's
Japanese.
Yeah, his job is. There's a might be German, I think. He looks pretty French. I'll make that guy. But the point is, there were 9 or 10 different countries who sent troops here, including Australians who fought under the British flag at this time. Now the Japanese aren't finished. They defeated China up here. Now the Russians also have designs on Manchuria. And the Russians at this time control this area here. And they're competing for influence in Korea. So at the same time, Korea is united under a dynasty that's been there for 1,000 years. But they're weak, if not weaker, than the Chinese dynasty. And they're ripe for the fall. And all the fighting here happens in Korea and this part of Liaoning province as it is now. And this is a major event. Why? Why is it a big deal that Japan defeated the Russians in this war?
Because Because the Russians were a big influence in China.
Yeah, definitely. Why else?
Wasn't Russia like the superpower in the world at the time? One of them?
It was one of the European great powers for sure. Why else? How do Europeans see themselves in relation to the rest of the world at this time?
Superior.
Yes, there's a lot of racial superiority. They look at Asians as inferior peoples. But hang on. Here's this Asian country coming and smashing the navy of one of the great powers of Europe. So this is a really big jolt to the European imagination. And this is really Japan announces itself as a world power by defeating Russia, you know, an important European country. But what it does, and the Treaty of Portsmouth is the treaty that was signed afterwards, which gave Japan open slather to move into the Korean Peninsula. And this begins their imperial adventure. Now what you see here is Japanese troops moving into the Korean capital of Seoul. And you can see these are Seoul locals, these are Yangban elites, they're called. So these are the upper class of Korean society at that time. These are the peasants. And you can see it looks very backward in comparison to the modernised Japanese force. So Japan had no trouble going into Korea and taking control. And the Koreans suffered Japanese imperialism for the longest period of any Asian country. Are you up to here yet in your reading? This is the end of the Qing Dynasty.
We've read it, but I'm not sure
how long we know. Okay, so we've established that the Qing government is corrupt, it's weak, and foreign powers have hollowed it out. It can't survive. There's been a rebellion, or several rebellions already, but it gets to a point where their rule can't be sustained. Now the Wuchang Uprising, Wuchang was down here in the south somewhere. And this was a small uprising that brought the nationalist Chinese. Have you heard of Sun Yat-sen?
Yes.
Yeah, that's Sun Yat-sen, very important figure in Chinese history. He comes to prominence, and this uprising in Wuchang leads to the Xinhai Revolution, which is essentially the overthrow of the Qing dynasty. It's over by February of 1912, and the Republic of China is proclaimed. But what happens when a government... Oh, we'll get to that in a sec. This is the Empress, Empress Dowager Cixi. And this little guy here is the last emperor, Pu Yi. You ever seen the film The Last Emperor? That available in your library?
Could be, I'm not sure.
Yeah, but it's a classic and it documents this guy's life. But anyway, he assumed the throne when he was only about 3 or 4 years old, and by the time he was 5, that was the end of the Qing dynasty. I mean, you can't sustain a government when its leader's 5 years old, can you? Obviously not. And so this is troops in the Wuchang Uprising, nationalist troops. And this is a street in Shanghai after the Xinhai Revolution, and this is the first nationalist flag here. So everyone's happy, everyone's celebrating. The hated Qing dynasty's come to an end. And there's Sun Yat-sen. Now, I was about to say before, what happens when a government or a whole governing system that's been around for ages just falls apart and it's not there anymore?
It has to be replaced, possibly.
Yeah. And is that it?
And then that didn't work. Replacing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And you have to, you can't really sweep the slate clean. You've got to use remnants from the old system. And one of those remnants is this guy. So what do you know about him? Yuan Shikai.
Is a Machiavellian leader?
Yeah.
He wanted to make a republic, but he just kind of pretty much make himself emperor by using the army. So.
Yeah, exactly right. So he was a general in the Qing army, And when Sun Yat-sen and the revolutionaries had the Xinhai Revolution, they realised they couldn't achieve anything unless they had the support of the army. So Sun Yat-sen says, I was going to be the Prime Minister, but I'm going to give that role to Yuan so we can get the army on side and we can sustain the revolution, because we need the army to keep law and order. Because without law and order, you can't run a stable country. But you're right. Yuan ends up trying to be an emperor himself. He tries to establish his own dynasty. And you can see him here being carried on a litter. He sees himself as an emperor, and he's a megalomaniac. What does that mean, a megalomaniac?
Is that he lost power?
I was thinking power.
Yeah, he is. An unnatural love of power. Power is everything to him, at the exclusion of all other priorities. And he makes bad decisions. And his rule quickly becomes as corrupt as the people he's replaced. But it doesn't last very long. He generates lots of resistance. And he ends up being deposed, and he dies not long after that in 1916. And without a stable government, we have the warlord period. And the country essentially falls apart. It fragments into different parts. So on this map you can see sort of the different little gangster countries that come up. And why would I say that they're little gangster countries?
They're on like warlords, which get like little mafias or little mobs or
exactly
something.
Right, yeah. And often these are guys who used to be, you know, military leaders under the Qing. And they're the guys that have the best weapons, they've got loyal men, etc. So they can become the government by default. Now, what do you know about this guy, Chiang Kai-shek?
That's the guy whose name is...
Chiang Jishi. They've got a different in there.
Yeah. This is the old-style spelling of his name.
Yeah. So he was sort of taught a bit by Sun Yat-sen, and then he was meant to take over Sun Yat-sen's position, or he wormed his way into Sun Yat-sen's position when Sun Yat-sen died.
Yeah.
And took over the... GMD,
yeah, the Kuomintang.
Kuomintang.
The GMD for short, yeah. Or KMT as it used to be called. So this pinyin style, there's two different styles of writing Chinese characters in Roman numerals, in English script. The old way is called Wei Giles, and you get spelling like this. And the new way, pinyin, is where you get his new name. I don't even know his new name.
Cheng
Jishi,
is it?
Cheng Jishi, yeah.
Cheng Koshi.
Yeah. But most commonly, apart from in China, in the West, he's known by the old name. So we have the warlord period. It's very chaotic. Chiang Kai-shek gets control of the nationalist armies down here in the south, and he leads what's called the Northern Expedition. And through this expedition, Chiang manages to reunify a large portion of China, gets rid of the warlords, defeats them in battle, and this is where we get the sort of the second Republic of China. Also in this time, in 1921, something important happens, important to our story about Mao.
The Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, that's right. The Chinese Communist Party is founded.
Wasn't it in 1921?
Possibly.
We just read about a historiographical debate.
Yes, there is a debate. Yeah. But either way, it doesn't... And then when you're talking about history, the exact dates are not important as the trends in which they're located. And that's a historical debate in itself, what's more important. But anyway, the Chinese Communist Party is founded as a wing of the nationalists, as a wing of the Chinese nationalists. So they're together, but there's differences in ideology and philosophy. So when I talk about ideology, what do I mean?
Sort of like the morals and ideas of the party.
Yeah, they're the ideas you have that shape the actions that you take. So the nationalists, as a core, have one set of ideas about how they want to go forward, and the communists have a different set of ideas based on Marxism and socialism. And we can talk about what's involved in that a bit later if you want. So he's part of the Northern Expedition. But here what we see, yeah, quite gruesome.
Is this someone's head?
Yeah, it is. This guy, this happened in Shanghai, this guy is a communist. And what we see in 1927, amidst the Northern Expedition, is a split between the nationalists, between the Kuomintang and the Communist Party. Because they find they can't work together anymore, and the nationalists want the power. And so they launched this big massacre of communist sympathisers in Shanghai, which this is a depiction. So it's important that you see stuff like this. This is a gruesome period. All through the period I've been talking about, people are dying in large numbers. It's very violent. It's very unstable. It's very chaotic. Not a good time. So from this period, from the split, China's in civil war. You've got the nationalists, the Kuomintang, fighting against the Chinese Communist Party. And in this period, this 10-year period from 1927, the nationalists are winning. The communists aren't yet a really powerful force. And the nationalists essentially bring them to their knees and corner the communist armies down here in the south. This is a picture of the nationalist government headquarters in Nanking, which they established at the end of the Northern Expedition.
Sorry, what was the dates for that?
Yeah, sorry, I'm reading on. Now, Brett, this should be written on your timelines too. Now, this is where, I know, that's quite a bit of background information, just to get to Mao, who is really the subject of our discussion today. And this is where Mao the Revolutionary comes to the fore. And he comes to the fore in something called the Long March. So I know we're well ahead of where your reading's at the moment, but what do you know anything about the Long March? This is a very famous event. Obviously it's a long walk by its title. Who's that guy? Yeah, it's Mao. It's in this expedition that Mao comes to the fore and rises to the pinnacle of his party. So the Long March is essentially a series of long treks by communist armies who are on the run. They're being whipped by the nationalists. And they're trying to retreat. And they go on these epic walks. And bear in mind, the nationalist armies are harassing them all the way. So there's combat, they're retreating. This is really, you know, it's the stuff of action movies. And I end up here in Yunnan. Of the approximately 100,000 communist troops and sympathisers that start out on these marches, only about 5,000 make it here. So that's an extraordinary rate of attrition for the communists. They're nearly wiped out. But they make it to Yunnan. They set up a base, they bide their time, they grow strong again, and eventually they'll come to challenge the nationalists once more. But through this march, Mao becomes the central figure in the Communist Party. He becomes their leader, and he does that by getting respect in this really serious combat situation. He's undisputed leader now, and he has loyalty. So this is him at the time. Another thing he does on this march, the communists get a lot of help from peasants and farm people in the places that they're retreating through. And Mao, the young Mao here, makes a big impression on the people that he comes into contact with. And this is important later on when we come to the revolution, because the peasants are really the main force of the communist revolution and why they can defeat the nationalists in the end. But the civil war gets interrupted. What happens here? Why is the civil war interrupted?
Well, apparently Japan attacks.
They do. So if you want to know the real date for the start of World War II, here it is.
Oh, it's the Nanking Massacre and all that stuff.
Yeah. So it's not the traditional date of 1939 to do with Hitler. The Pacific War started well, well before, 10 years before. Here's a picture of a map of the territories that the Japanese ended up capturing in China during the war. So a large, remember, they came up through here into Japan, Korea, then they took Manchuria, and then they came down here from the north. They captured these strategic ports. They'd already captured Taiwan as part of the first Sino-Japanese War in 1895. And then they start hopping down into Southeast Asia. So why did the Civil War come to a pause during this period?
Because isn't that the same area where the nationalists were?
Yeah, absolutely.
So they were a bit preoccupied.
So what happens if two people are having a fight and then an even stronger person comes and gets in and starts attacking them both?
They fight with them.
Yeah, that's right. They come to an unholy alliance. You can see here's Chiang Kai-shek, here's Mao. And I bet they're cursing each other under their breath as they're having this toast. But they come to an understanding that they need to defeat the Japanese. Otherwise, all of them are going to get wiped out. Now, what happens in 1945? Yeah, exactly. Japan's defeated, two atomic bombs, their empire in East Asia falls apart. And this alliance between the nationalists and the communists quickly falls apart. A smart thing the communists did while the war was going on is they sort of sat in the background and let the nationalists do most of the fighting against the Japanese. So what do you think happened to the nationalist army? Yeah, all their best fighters got killed. They used a lot of their resources and their manpower. So by the end of World War II, and when the Civil War restarts, the nationalists are no longer more powerful than the communists. It's much more equal, and in fact the communists are more powerful. And you can see by these dates, it doesn't take that long for the communists to win the Civil War. On the back of the peasants. Remember, the nationalists had their main power base of people in the cities, people who had a fair amount of money, and they were quite corrupt. They ran their war machine by taxing the peasants and the farmers. So there was a lot of resentment among this group against the nationalist government. Now, it's interesting at this time that China is mostly an agricultural society. Not that many people live in the city. So the peasants and the farmers, they're the main group of the population. So by alienating the main group of the population, the nationalists were really at a massive disadvantage when the Civil War restarted. And because Mao was very good at mobilising the peasants and getting them on his side, the communists had a great deal of support in the countryside. And that's what helped them win the war. And you can see here, he's talking to some farmers. He's a charismatic guy. He knows how to talk to people. At this time, anyway. He knows how to get them on side. And he's a big guy. He's got presence. Mao is a very tall man. How big was he, Martin?
Just like six.
Yeah, 6 foot six, or about 200 centimetres. You know, like I say, much taller than me. Big man. Has a real presence about him. And people flock to that, especially in times of chaos. You want a guy like that who you can rally to.
And look that tall there.
Yeah. Does that mean they're all 6 foot six?
I'd be willing to bet that he's standing on a hill.
Because it looks like a propaganda show.
Yeah.
Like equality.
Yeah, exactly. That's part of the propaganda. Is you're no longer under the thumb of the nationalists who are taxing you, who are treating you like crap. You're equal. We're brothers. We're comrades, and we're going to create this communist utopia, so get on board and we'll create a better society for you. That's part of the communist vision, why it was so attractive to people, is that it's promising a better world. In hindsight, we can see that it didn't work, that it was horrible, that it collapsed. But in this time, You know, China's been racked by war for almost 100 years. That message of a better world is really appealing. And you can see why people flock to it. This is a picture of the communist troops as they entered Beijing in 1945. You can see massive support. People are really excited about it. And this, what event's this? What's the big square in Beijing called?
Tiananmen Square.
Yep, Tiananmen Square. In 1949, in October, Mao stood on top of the gates of the Forbidden City. You know the Forbidden City? It's the old imperial palace, but it overlooks the square. And here, he's proclaiming the establishment of the People's Republic of China. This is the start of the communist Chinese state. Really famous moment. If you look on YouTube, you can get audio and video of his pronouncement. It's quite crusty audio quality, but it's worth having a look at just because it's such a momentous event. All right, so you with me so far? And remember, any questions, yell out. All right, this is where we get to Mao, the national leader. So as a revolutionary, Mao's a genius. He's a strategic genius as a guerrilla leader. He knows how to unite people. He knows how to fight. And he knows how to win. Are those necessarily good qualities if you're trying to administer a country?
No.
Why not?
You're going to end up killing people.
Well, yes. That's the essence of the story I'm about to tell. What qualities would be good as an administrator of a country?
Administration skills. Fairness.
Willing to be other people's views and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else?
Ethics.
Yep. Any other qualities?
Experience in a country or in government probably would help.
Well, he was some sort of leader, so I do think that's...
But also running the country, right?
But it was still... He did have experience in, say, a rule over people. Mm-hmm. He knew how to influence them, what attracted them.
Did he have any expertise in economics?
No.
Or running a bureaucracy? Or keeping records? Getting the trains to run on time? Getting water to people, you know, simple things, stuff that we take for granted because our society is well organised. We just think this stuff happens by magic. But in countries like this, none of this exists because it's in such a state of chaos. Mao could never get any of this stuff happening. Now, there's three specific events that I want to touch on. Did you know anything about the 100 Flowers campaign and what it might mean? At the time this was proclaimed, Mao said, "I want to let 100 flowers bloom." What's he referring to here? Yeah, yeah. What about them? So you were talking about equality just before and listening to alternative voices.
So he wants to hear 100 people's views.
Yeah, that's right. So he comes out and makes a big deal about, okay, I want to hear what you've got to say. Our country's in a dire state because we're still weak. We want to improve the economy. We want to improve people's lives. Tell me what you think. So people do. And what happens to them? That's what happens to them. They get denounced as rightists. Do you know about the left-right ideological? Yeah, so the left is the communists, and the right is the capitalists and the fascists. And so the people that come out and say, okay, we don't think you're doing a good job, do it like this. He says, right, your enemies of the country. And they get persecuted, some of them get purged and killed. So that's not a great way to get alternative voices in the country, is it? Now, not long after that, now that Mao's dealt with all the smart people, how can we industrialise our economy? Remember, this is still a farming society. And he wants to accelerate China's development as an industrial power by making stuff with steel and manufacturing.
So that's kind of tough.
Stuff to wear,
sort of. What is all this stuff?
Metal.
Yeah, right. So what are they doing with it?
I'm guessing taking it somewhere to make something out of it.
So
Mao's yeah. So big idea, he said, right, it takes a lot of money and a lot of investment to set up big factories. But what we can do is set up these little iron smelters in each village. And each village collect all the metal stuff you've got and make iron that way. If everyone does it on a small scale, we can get over the fact that we don't have enough money to invest in big factories. So this is the little village kilns. Everyone's smelting metal. What's the problem with doing this?
It's dangerous.
Yeah.
They have no skill at doing it.
No expertise. So what's the product like that they make?
Crap.
Yeah. Yes, rubbish. All the stuff they made is unusable.
So basically they just
had
usable metal and they melted it down to non-usable.
So think of like your best cutlery, think of your pipes, think of your farm tools. So all this useful stuff they didn't have anymore. Shit, we've got to sow the crops. Where's all our tools? Oh, we smelted them to make nothing. Also, like everyone in the village flocks to start making metal. What's not happening while they're at the kilns?
No farming.
Yeah, that's right. So there's no one sowing the crops. There's no one doing the harvest. And what's the inevitable result of that? There you go, very disturbing footage. 30 million people.
He's having fun.
He got the background tattoo.
This is his saying 30 million people die.
Yeah, you guys are laughing.
You've got to look on the bright side.
One happy guy in China is dying.
Look, he's probably happy because he found a cob of corn on the ground. Happiness is relative in times like this. There's 30 million people. Think of that. In 3 years, 2 or 3 years, 30 million people. Australia's got a population of, what, 22 million people? Oh. So that's the end of Australia in 3 years. Equivalent to that. What kind of impact does that have on a country? That kind of disaster.
So same as like the taping the bone and the box and they start distrusting the government as not doing a good job.
Yeah, exactly right. So what happens to Mao? Do you know what happens to Mao after this?
Doesn't he flee?
He doesn't flee, but he is forced to step down as the chairman of the Communist Party. So he's not the supreme leader anymore, and it's a big loss of face. There's a concept in China called face. You know about face and losing face? In Chinese it's called mianzi. So it'd be good to look it up because it's a really important. If you want to deal with Chinese people, it's good to know about this. Having face is really important in Asian cultures. And losing face is the really serious thing. For Mao, and this is a devastating loss of face, when he's forced to step down. And he's no longer in power. This is the guy who's rescued the country and led the revolution. And now he's made this very silly mistake. Yeah. But that's not the end of him. Do you know what he does next? As if what's happened beforehand doesn't make China chaotic enough. Mao, in an effort to return to the supreme leadership of the Communist Party in the country, launches what we call the Cultural Revolution. Now, lots of things happen here, but basically what Mao does is he uses young people. He organises them in groups called the Red Guards. So you see all these faces here. These are people that are your age. Or only slightly older. And he hands out these things, the little red books.
These are collections of Mao's teachings and thoughts on the world. And this is sort of like a Bible for these young people. And they read it and they have little clubs, sort of like the Boy Scouts, but much more hardcore. More like Hitler Youth, if you know anything about World War II in Europe. It's indoctrination, it's brainwashing. But he gets these young people to lead a campaign against everything that's old and ancient in the society. So he's trying to sweep away the existing power hierarchy so that he can come back to the top of the Communist Party and return to his rule. So when we talk about... Oh, here you go, here's the red books. This is in Tiananmen Square, there's the entrance to the Forbidden City. That's where Mao was standing when he proclaimed the People's Republic. And these are all red guards with their little red books. Apparently there was something like 30 or 40 billion of these printed, these little red books. Was it that much?
No, it wasn't that much.
No, I've got my numbers wrong, haven't I?
It's like 3 billion.
Yeah, it was about 4 or 5 books for every person in China at the time. Which is why you can still buy them now. Even though these are copies, I do have a couple of originals in my office. And you can still buy them in China. So what are they sweeping away? Old stuff. What's this old stuff? The four olds.
Like religious idols.
Yeah, that's right. So Buddhist temples were looted. Old books. Old knowledge. You know, you're wiping away your cultural heritage of thousands of years by burning it in this fervour of mayhem. People are brainwashed. They're going crazy. It's out of control. What do you think's going on here?
Posting his teachings on the walls.
Yeah, partially. That's definitely happening. If you go to North Korea today, you can see a similar thing happening there. These are lists of people who are being denounced. And again, does this look familiar to the slide we saw before from the 100 Flowers campaign? At this time, people had to do things called, go to regular meetings called self-criticism sessions, where you'd stand up and say, like a group like this, each one of you would stand up and you'd say everything that you'd done wrong within the last week. And you'd say how you transgressed the teachings of Mao Zedong, and then you'd say what you're going to do to atone for it. Then everyone in the crowd would yell out things that you'd done wrong. And then the superiors would yell out things that you'd done wrong. And if you're in the crowd, you invent things. You're attacking other people so that people don't attack you. And what do you think is the outcome of this kind of process?
Low self-esteem.
To say the least.
Suicide rates?
Yeah, oh definitely. There's a suicide epidemic. There's a murder epidemic. What's the purpose of doing this?
The country goes nuts and he's another leader to step up and say Mao can get it.
Hello.
Yeah, so Mao's regained control at this point. What's the point of this kind of meeting?
I guess because nobody's saying anything bad about Mao, they can see everything he's doing is actually good. Like, we're bad, he's sort of like God, we should listen to him.
Do you think in this kind of environment, would any of you be friends?
No.
No. So who's your only friend?
Mao.
Exactly right, that's the whole point. Mao's put up, just like you said, he's the God of the society. Yeah, and everyone else, because they can't trust or rely on anyone else around them, they rely on Mao as the leader to look after them. That's the whole point. And this is a common theme across communist countries. You see this in the Soviet Union under Stalin, in North Korea, even up to the present day, in any countries where a leader is trying to maintain social control. Also, because they're attacking old knowledge, anyone who's smart
gets denounced, gets purged, gets sent to forced labour camps out in the countryside, where they do hard labour and there's really high death rates because they're, you know, it's a prison camp. Or they're outright murdered. So people like me, people like Logan, people like my students here, because they're educated, are getting, they're getting purged. A purge is the appropriate name for this. So what's the consequence for society if all the smart people are gotten rid of?
He doesn't have anyone to challenge him, I guess, if they find his ruling or teachings wrong.
Yeah, so that's Mao's purpose, and that suits him just fine. But what's the practical...
Education.
Sorry?
That's no education.
Yeah. And what's the long-term outcome of that?
You can't teach other people, and, like, their generations, like, grow up and they're, like,
the educated people we go to see for help all the time.
Doctors.
Doctors, lawyers, writers, engineers, scientists.
All of the above. So you can't develop a society without that kind of expertise. And it probably sets back China 30 or 40 years until they can regenerate people with those kind of skills or get them from the outside. Yeah, man.
It's probably worth noting, like, that whole idea of killing off the academic echelons of society. Like, you also need to consider Mao's background earlier in life. Mao could never afford to go to university. He actually worked as a library assistant at Peking University, which is the head university of Beijing. So he read all of the Confucius teachings, ancient philosophies and things, but he was continually mistreated, denigrated by high academics. For his inability to be able to afford university.
So you're saying it's like his way of getting back
in? No, it's not just that, but it plays on a lot of the things that Mao does. I mean, if you look at his early life.
So it, like, affected his view on education?
It's affected the way that he leads as well. He had to go certain ways.
Yeah,
there's
people with
affiliation
it.
With fathers and peasants, because he was from that lower
class.
Because
he's had to come from the lower echelons of society.
Kind of have a
distrust. Yeah, that's true. You see that in Hitler too, in Germany. He's a guy who never really, he wanted to be an artist, he never really made it. He was mocked. He was in the army in World War I, he wasn't particularly good. And he carried a really big chip on his shoulder. And you can see people with a burning anger inside that isn't treated tend to express that anger by harming other people. And if you're one of those people that happens to be in charge of lots of other people, you can do a lot of damage. And it's not just, you know, dictators, it's people who are in charge of companies, it's bad teachers that you might have. Anyone who's in a position to harm someone else. Fortunately, Logan's a champion. But in your life, you will see this. So it's good to know about it. And that's also why it's good to treat everyone with respect, no matter where you are in life and where they are in life. Because you never know what kind of impact you might have on them down the line. Alright. We're going to peel off into some small groups here. Three. If you want to get into three groups of five, or thereabouts, or four. Yeah, two fours and one five. So this middle table here, if you guys want to come over here, and LTU students, if you want to grab a group. Now what I'd like you to do in your groups is discuss this question. On balance, was Mao good or bad for China? Now this, I know this is a simple question, but one, it relates to your first assessment task, I believe. And two, this is a debate that goes on continually in China to this day. Because Mao is such an important figure in their society and in world history. So, I don't want you to straddle the fence, I want you to take a position.
And everyone in the group's got to arrive at a consensus, which means you all have to agree. So discuss, come to the position that you think you can come to. Alright. It's now time to climb off the fence and take a position. So, Lisa, your group,
what? Okay, my pronoun.
No, you're not talking, David, but I'm with you.
Yeah,
I'm not.
Sorry, no, we were asking now.
Firstly, I can't decide anymore. I want to commit genocide right now.
Zach, come to us.
The genocide?
No, he's eating me out. He's eating me out.
I don't know what I am.
So we didn't decide.
So what was the group consensus? Nothing.
So pretty much, you went by majority that anti-male would win,
went by the loudest voice,
yeah.
That male would win.
Exactly. That's it.
Do we hear? Hang on.
Now the other
yes or no? Like,
the other reason that this is interesting
yes,
is because at the top of the Chinese government, there's no supreme leader anymore. There's a group of people who make decisions, and they make decisions by consensus. So exactly what you're doing now, trying to reach. Find what you agree on. So this is an important exercise in how to reach decisions as a team, not just how to reach decisions about Mao. So, yeah.
Oh, well, I was just thinking then, if we were Mao, if Taya disagreed with me, I could just kill her.
We can't.
I think the correct term is purge.
You would kill her. You would have your goons come and arrest her, take her to a prison camp where she would expire quite rapidly from hard labour and...
I would uprise. I'd dig myself into the dirt, and you would never know where I went. And then I just.
And then you would just for not being able to talk.
All right, Martin's group at the back here.
Shut up.
We don't like the word good, so we're going to say he was necessary.
Ah, very, very nuanced.
The question specifically asked. All that, you cannot change the question. So please answer the question.
So what's your reasoning?
Yeah. Right. Well, necessary. Because the means were very nice per se, but in the long run, he set the foundation for what China's become, and you can't out-argue that. So without Mao the revolutionary, and getting China united and all that stuff, China now, as we know it, would be there.
So it was
necessary, but not necessarily a good guy.
The process was bad, but the result was good.
So maybe good for China, maybe not good.
So what's your actual answer to the question?
They're calling good.
He's good.
For China.
Do we hear ours?
Now, hang on, I've got to comment on this first, but I will get to you.
I'm doing that group.
This raises a really good point. In international relations, a large group of theorists in that discipline say that this is a stupid question, because there's no such thing as good or bad in international relations. It's all about what's necessary to prosper and survive. So the fact that you've come up with that is quite an astute observation. This is a moral question. It's not a practical question. So well done, guys. Alright, Team Alicia.
We took a vote out of five of us.
And good one.
Two of us had good, two of us had bad.
And we had a donkey.
Alicia wrote donkey, so
we're
saying bad.
That's good. No, it's good.
Well, he wrote it.
No, but donkeys are good. That can go in the good part.
Yes, we
found
right
now,
donkeys,
yeah.
So we've had it very hard to decide because. Yeah, he did a lot of good things for China, but the way he went about doing it.
He's only human. People make mistakes. Exactly.
There's mistakes
and
mass murder for 50 million people.
So there's no consensus then, is the.
Yeah.
All right.
I like.
He's only human.
Okay. Well done. Now, just to wrap up, this is a very famous book called Wild Swans. You may or may not have heard of it. Is it in your lot?
It is in the lot.
Yeah. It's such a classic. All schools have it. This is written by this lady here, documenting the life of her mother and her grandmother, which spans right back to the beginning of the 20th century. And through their personal experiences, you know, documents everything that we've just talked about now. Great book, great read. And if you get a chance, it'll be really valuable to read while you're studying this.
Also, I'm handing out my business card. If you have any questions at all about stuff China.
I have a question for you right now. Are you pro or anti-Mao?
I'm with this group here. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, so don't hesitate to flick me an email if you've got any China related questions, or if you're going to China or overseas or somewhere and you want some advice. It's in Korean, actually, the writing on the back. Korean Peninsula Nuclear Weapons Program is my research area, so I go to Korea quite often. It's useful to have. I'm going to North Korea in the middle of the year.
If anything's your radio, I
think. If I come back looking a little bit different, you know there's a problem.
Of course, if you had like a few more limbs and stuff.
That's unfortunate for him. All right. Yeah, thanks. I'd like to thank Dr. Habib on behalf of Victor Lujo. Thank you very much. Thank you. And no doubt we'll be calling on you again soon.
I hope so. But you give yourselves a round of applause. You guys are the stars today. So good work.
Thanks for coming over in the rain.